All right, welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, and today I'm excited to bring on Dr. Damian Sojourner, Assistant Professor of Anthropology at the University of California, Irvine, and I'm excited to talk about his book, First Strike: Educational Enclosures in Black Los Angeles, and this is from University of Minnesota Press, 2016. Dr. Sojourner, thank you for coming on today.
Ryan, thank you very much for having me.
Fantastic. And if we could maybe just give our audience a little bit of background on yourself. How did you come along this subject? How did you get into education?
Well, I come from a family of educators. My grandfather on my mom's side was an educator. He taught at a black college in Houston, Texas. And when he and his family moved from Houston to LA, he actually couldn't find a job teaching, not even in secondary or primary school. But that's that gene sort of, I guess, more or less passed down in a proverbial way. My mom was a teacher. I have several aunts that are teachers as well. So I think maybe more than anything, that's how I sort of gravitated towards education in general.
Sure.
However, I think also my own personal experience of growing up, being in schools during the 1980s, 1990s, middle school and high school, and having the experience of something sort of being a little bit off. And what I mean by that was the amount of surveillance via either official police or school police, several forms of security to get into school, checking in with your ID at several checkpoints, just gates and barbed wire everywhere. And that has not subsided. It seems to have increased as time has gone on. Mm-hmm. So that, I think that's sort of what drew me to it. And in terms of looking at the relationship between schools and prisons, I think it was growing up in the middle of the expansion of prisons, in particular in California, the massive expansion of prisons within the state, mm-hmm. Having family members who were incarcerated, But then also having this other sort of massive state structure, the form of education that seemed to be doing many of the same things, but in a different light. Right. So that sort of drew me to look at how these two entities were connected.
Right. And in the book, you talk about the your own experience, I think, and sort of the juxtaposition between seeing a traditional or predominantly white school and maybe with your experience. I think what you're talking about now is perfect to open us up into the book, if we can get started. First, I think maybe you open up with addressing the idea or in the early chapter of a school to prison pipeline, and sort of, I think you dub it a STPP. So can you kind of talk about that term and maybe why it might also be problematic as well?
So sure. So the term the school to prison pipeline was first developed in the mid 1980s and further developed in the early 90s by community activists who were looking to explain what was happening with schools, because you had the intensification of policing. The drastic intensification of policing on school grounds. And so schools, many groups saw as turning from less of a place of education and more to a training ground for prisons. This sort of phrasing and method was then more or less sort of co-opted by the state. And what I mean by the state, like the formal wing of the state,
sure.
The Department of Ed, the state of California has actually used it several times to host symposiums. It has become a part of the sort of formal processes of understanding education within black schools. Mm-hmm. Now, what happened during this co-optation process, by and large, was an erasure of the organizing that was key in bringing it to the fore back in the mid-80s and early 90s, but then also to change the direction and scope of what education has been historically in the United States, and then also to more or less take away the potency of understanding what's going on with prisons. And what I mean by that is that within this arc of the school to prison pipeline, we understand schools to be this sort of utopic endeavor that has been somehow corrupted by prisons and by prison expansion to a certain extent. The solution for that by the state has not been to address the root causes of prison expansion or even the root causes of what's going on within education, but rather to address the individual behavior of students. And so that's where the sort of bastardization of restorative justice has come in and placed the locus on students to just admit to their wrong behaviors. And if they can change their behaviors, then somehow, some way, they will not go to quote unquote prisons. This is being a large part of it. Mm. Now, what this completely does away with is the fact that schools have been a central part of Black containment, even prior to the massive expansion of prisons, in particular within the state of California. Mm. So that prisons have, during the 1980s, 1990s, Ruth Wilson Gilmore, in her wonderful book, Golden Gulag, describes that what took place in California was the largest expansion of prisons in the history of the world. And so while you have this massive prison expansion, much of the techniques of control that we associate with prisons, lockdowns and surveillance of that type and bars and things of this nature, and policing in particular, were already happening in education. And so I write about that briefly in a book and in another article as well, that in late 1960s, you see this happen within public schools, in particular with Black schools in L.A. And that only intensifies. So in many ways, it's the sort of a long way of getting to this, is that rather than look at it as a school to prison pipeline, we really need to look at in what ways actually did education inform the development of prisons. And so rather than looking at it as a linear direction from schools to prisons, there's actually an articulation that's going back and forth between the two in some ways. And it's in some instances, what I called enclosures in the book, sometimes addressed only in facets of education, sometimes only happened within prisons, sometimes there was a back and forth. But this notion that is unilateral from schools to prisons actually does us a disservice in trying to, if the goal is really to address what's happening, A, in prisons, but then also what's happening within the realm of education, it does us a disservice of understanding the root causes of these issues.
Sure, sure. So, I mean, you kind of already mentioned it, the idea of enclosures in chapter one, which you call the problem of Black genius, Black cultural enclosures. You introduce County High School. So can you maybe talk about working with that school and what it was like in that school? And you also in that chapter talk about sort of Western Christianity and how it has affected the Black community.
Sure. So one of the ways in which sort of the failure of the school to prison pipeline to address one of the key facets is what happens in these schools outside of the range of discipline. Mm-hmm. And so I think the school to prison pipeline does a very good job of looking at rates of suspension, detention, expulsion, and showing how there's great disproportionality when it comes to race and how these forms of discipline are meted out. What's not looked at, however, is how teaching pedagogically and curriculum has been completely eviscerated. And the argument that I make in the book is that Black culture in particular has been completely removed from public education. And Black culture, meaning the expression of Black culture itself, music, the arts, dance, performance, language, all of these things have been under severe attack. And I look at Christianity because argument that I'm making here is that the roots of this are within Western forms of Christian domination. And so if you take a step back and just look at what took place, for example, during slavery, and how Christianity was complicit, directly complicit, in muting all forms of expressions of the former enslaved, from the moment of, literally from the moment of stepping onto the boat to once enslaved or here on plantations, you can see that the intent was to dampen and stop Black forms of cultural expression, because it was understood that these were at the base of revolt and rebellion on one hand, but on the other hand, also went against every type of, for lack of a better word, stereotype that said that Black people had no past, no historical past. Because if they had a historical past, then they wouldn't, let me rephrase, if they did not have a historical past, then how could they bring with them all of this knowledge? So that has to be completely changed and stopped in order to justify the slavery as an enterprise, because completely negated Blackness in that way.
If I could ask you also just about the CHS, the school that that you sort of introduce us to, how did you sort of get involved or find them, and what was your experience working with the school?
So I was a roving sub at the school, roving long-term sub at the school for a year, for a school year. And so I had, my experience was actually, it was liminal in the sense that as a sub, you sort of, your employment is a little bit precarious on one hand.
Sure.
But on the other hand, I was sort of free to do certain things that other teachers weren't able to do, which is because, you know, you have to, as a teacher, you have to abide by the state standards, which are very limiting, because at that time, California just recently changed it. But at that time, the state standards had to were in line with the state exit exam, which were proven to pretty much prove nothing at all. But being as a roving sub, oftentimes I was left without a plan of action for the day. And so I would have to ask the students, you know, what did you do yesterday? And we sort of would just sort of riff off of that. And that provided some flexibility to teach upon the material, but in a way that was much different than what the standards offered. In that way, my experience was very good. The school as a whole, however, was in line with what we talked about earlier.
Sure.
That there was massive levels of security on campus. There was a huge gate around the school. You had to show your ID when you went in. There was sheriffs that were on the outside. There was school police that were inside. There was staffing, school security staffing as well inside. So and the school was set up by a series of fences that were blocked off at certain times of the day, literally would funnel kids into certain areas of the school. So you always got the sense that you were being watched.
Right.
Always, like constantly being watched. And there was a sheriff's department on campus as well, so that if anything happened at all, the smallest infraction, the threat of being sent to the sheriff's department and what would follow with that was always on your mind. So you can be issued a citation on campus for just looking like you're about to get into a fight, and that carried with it punitive forms of discipline in terms of money you have to pay for, fees, court costs. That whole system would kick in really, really fast.
Right. If I can interject and just ask a question on that account. You talk about in chapter 3, which you call Land of Smoke and Mirrors, the meaning of punishment and control. You talk about this policy as a way to delegitimize organization efforts. Can you maybe talk a little about that?
Yeah, so that has a longer history, which dates back to, when, in particular in California, I should in Southern California, when you had a lot of Black Southerners first came here from Texas and Louisiana into the state, And the initial interaction between these schools that more or less became black over a period of roughly 5 to 10 years was very tense with the white families that were there. Mm-hmm. So there was race riots that happened, most famously at Fremont High School in the late 1940s. But what was also happening was a lot of organizing that was taking place on these high school campuses, mm-hmm. where organizations such as the Black Panther Party were on campus and recruiting students on one hand, right? And then what you see later on is that this same effort takes up in earnest with the Crips and the Bloods. Mm-hmm. Now, the Crips, when you say Crips and Bloods, just like notions of wild violence like pops up. But when you actually go back and look at the origins of these groups, it's much different than what we understand them to be right now. So, and the origins being is that they were literally radical groups that were more or less like the offspring of the Black Panther Party, by and large. So this type of organizing had to be clamped down. So by the time that you get to the 2000s, what you see is the genealogy of that logic played out with just overabundance of policing, mm-hmm. which is not about crime or safety, but which is making sure that they're trying to control this black population, which comes from this history of organizing against the very thing that they're being held down in these schools for in the first place.
Yeah. So on that notion again, in your next chapter, you also talk about the limits of organizing in maybe a similar way, but through this heteronormative sort of masculinity. Can you maybe get into a little of how that might have formulated, and then again how that is specifically organizing is a part of that as well.
Right. So that the solution to sort of what's been constructed as black educational failure, mm-hmm. has been to that, you know, black, in particular, this focuses on black boys.
Sure.
That black boys need black men in their life. And if they have black men in their life as mentors, then this would be the golden ticket to helping these black boys sort of see the error in their ways and becoming proper citizens. Now, this is an old tactic, a very old tactic. Most famously, that was brought up with the Moynihan Report. But it even predates that. There's at the turn of the 20th century, there's a meeting of black Catholics, and they're discussing what's wrong with the black family. And it goes back to this, like what's wrong with the black family is that there's no men around. And so the roots of this are very, 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 very old. However, for the current moment, the argument that black boys just need black men in their lives does much harm to the black community as a whole. And this argument is made wonderfully by Beth Ritchie in her book, Arrested Justice, which talks about the prison system and the problematics of focusing inherently on black men as the problem, and what that does to the black community, but also the violence that it mets out against black women. Mm-hmm. And what I track is what happens when you focus solely on black men and all of the violence that's going on with black women, it becomes completely ignored. And in fact, I argue that much of the problem and much of the issues in terms of violence and the reproduction of violence that happens with black boys is the root causes of this are in fact violence that is going on, and perpetuated against black women. Mm-hmm. And so that if you don't get at the root cause of the violence or what's looked at as terms of failure within the community, then you're going to have a serious, serious problem. Now that chapter's sort of goes in different directions in different places.
Sure.
But the reason why it does that is to understand how complex this issue is, and it's being just condensed down to we need to focus on Black boys, which is highly problematic.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, this all of the subjects we're talking about, I think, in this book have this complexity, which I think you certainly bring out. And to the viewer, if you're interested in this and want to hear more, definitely check out the book by all means. But if we could keep moving along, you know, we get sort of to the end of your book, and you start to provide kind of a historical overview from sort of industrialization beyond and specifically for these what you call educational enclosures, almost countering this like Black freedom movement or other movements that are sort of looking to replace some of the regimes. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that sort of overview?
Sure. So what I do in that chapter is to show that the first call for public education in the United States to have an educated populace is during Reconstruction. And this is a radical move because the intent, the aim of it is to free up the economic base that was in the planter class through the funding of education that just won't educate Black people per se, but would educate everybody, women, poor whites, the vast majority of the population who did not have access to education at all. This plan becomes completely co-opted by the finance and industrial base in the North, whose intent is not at all to have an educated populace, but rather they want to reproduce class in very strict ways. Because, you know, we have to remember that in the South, there pretty much was only two classes. You had the very wealthy and the very poor, and that was it. Mm. And the North's intent is to remake class, right? You need a strong middle class. And so their form of education goes a long ways to make sure that this happens. And so education, in that sense, public education gets hijacked by that plan. And so that plan more or less is put into action on a federal national stage and in various states in order to both remake the South, but then also to form a public education base that is going to both reproduce a middle class on one hand, but then also to dampen any type of resistance efforts to the state, to the United States. And this is what Reconstruction was, in fact, doing, was it sort of breaking up the United States away from a state enterprise and more to localized forms of government, and not in terms of like state rights, but that Black folks literally were these projects, these experiments, where Black people were just left alone and left to their own devices and had their own ways of making education. And this proved to be very dangerous because they no longer need the state and the state in terms of a unit of control. So as you look to see how education unfolds from that point forward, what you see is this constant contestation between Black people who are asserting for a particular type of education and various manifestations that want to make sure that that type of education does not become the norm. Because if that becomes a norm, then you have serious problems for the reproduction of class, the reproduction of race, the reproduction of gender, all these things through which now education serves as a key part of doing that. And so when we get to a major part of that chapter, which looks at testing as well and the effect of what testing has done, the intent is to look back, to go back and see why was testing put in school in the first place? Because right now we understand testing and standardized testing as being sort of normative, that you need it in school, when in fact the intent of testing was to more or less serve as a tool. This was sort of kicked in during Nixon's administration, was to serve as a tool to legitimate Black failure. So that if you can show in a sort of a business model, like sort of nuts and bolts numbers, that people fail based upon their own merit, then you can't have any claims of why you should be educated, right? So why you should progress forward, whether it be from one particular school to another school, whether it be from to have access to a magnet program, whether have access to college, all these things become quantified. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, without getting into the mechanizations of testing and what the racial biases within all these tests, the inherent goal was to connect. How do we move from this industrial model all the way to this current model? And testing sort of serves as a bridge for the latter part of that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, I think that especially sort of the last part of that is so relevant to a lot of the conversations we're having in education right now, even with you know, the presidential candidates and some of their differences on educational views. But I guess we're kind of getting to the end of the interview, and if we could maybe just get your final word on what you would like people to kind of take away when they read your book, or what you would like them to think about when they're reading it. And then also, what are you working on next? What's your next sort of project?
Okay. So from the book, more than anything, would just be a serious reckoning with the root causes of sort of prison development and the calamity within education right now, and to not sort of look at these terms, which seem to make sense, school to prison pipelines and things of this nature, but to really dig deeper to figure out what's going on, and hopefully my book provides a means of doing that. And what I'm working on right now is a new project on fugitivity, black fugitivity in current spaces. So it's situated in LA. Mm. And there's an argument that I'm making in terms of understanding the quote-unquote dropouts, mm-hmm. But making that, changing the framing of that and looking at it in the frame of black fugitivity, and understanding that removing oneself from school is a logical decision based upon all of the issues that we more or less have discussed right now. Mm-hmm. That when you have rampant policing, the evisceration of what we think would be forms of education, what sense does it in fact make to go to school? Because it's not this what we see right now, this is not an education at all. It's a particular type of training, but it's not education.
Another, I think another important and certainly relevant issue for today. So we'll look forward to that. But in the meantime, I encourage everybody to go check out First Strike, Educational Enclosures in Black Los Angeles. And I want to thank the author, Dr. Damian Sojourner, for joining us today. Thank you for coming. And everyone out there, I hope you learned something.